Well, there's an invasion underway, but it's not quite what you think. Linda Moulton Howe will explain when we come back with her on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, tell us about the lionfish. What is the lionfish?
Well, have you ever had one in a fish tank or seen one that you know of? I have some beautiful photographs at earthfiles.com, my news website. And you look at this incredibly beautiful fish, and you can see why people for years have wanted to get these beautiful fish, especially when they're little, and put them in tanks until everything else in the fish tank starts disappearing into the stomach of the lionfish.
And it gets bigger and bigger.
It gets bigger. They can grow up to 18 inches. And as the people who try to deal with these fish say, anything that the lionfish can get its mouth around, it will swallow whole. Well, what has happened is it's native to the Indo-Pacific Ocean region, and that can extend from Western Australia and Malaysia all the way to French Polynesia, the Pitcairn Islands, Southern Japan, Southern Korea. It's a huge area where the lionfish is supposed to be on this planet. But in the late 1980s, the lionfish began invading southern Florida and up the East Coast because people who bought these pretty little lionfish.
Oh, they're gorgeous with the spikes and everything, right?
Oh, they're breathtaking to look at. Yeah. Well, they would start to grow. They would eat everything else in the tank, and so people would go and throw them usually back into the ocean. And by the end of the 1990s, lionfish invaders were rapidly increasing in population, and they had spread to the Bahamas by 2004. And last year, now we're up to 2009, the lionfish has become the number one invasion concern for marine and environmental groups that are trying to protect corals and the crustaceans and dozens of other valuable marine fish from these voracious lionfish that are beginning to take over. In fact, scientists have found an entire small octopus inside one of these fish. And part of the problem, as they see it now, is that whatever keeps the lionfish in check in its native Indo-Pacific ocean ranges is apparently not present in southern Florida, Bermuda, and Bahama waters. And this lionfish is out of control. Marine scientists also realized that the eggs and the larvae of the lionfish are distributed right on the currents that tend to run north along the east coast of the United States, right along the Gulf Stream current. And now, those lionfish that have become established in the Caribbean are circling back to South Florida waters and up the coast and eating everything that they can swallow. And today, millions of lionfish are thriving in the Atlantic. And since there is no natural predator, lionfish are reproducing at what scientists report is the rate, get this, of 30,000 eggs every 4 to 7 days.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, the venom of the lionfish is delivered on those beautiful sort of needle-like spine dorsal fins that make it look so incredible in photographs. They can have 18 of those, all filled with a really venomous sting. And it can be horribly painful to humans, and it can cause nausea and breathing difficulties, but it's rarely fatal. And while those spines contain that painful venom, the white flesh is, by people who have eaten it and I've talked to, they say it's delicious and very safe to eat. And that is why Ladd Aitken, director of special projects for what is called the Reef Environmental Education Foundation, also known as Reef, in Key Largo, Florida, is trying to organize lionfish catching derbies everywhere to teach people how to grab these invaders with puncture-proof gloves and cook them up for dinner. In fact, the slogan now in Bermuda is, quote, eat them to beat them, and that they've got those on signs everywhere. Well, recently I talked with Ladd Aitken about the challenge to keep the lionfish from taking over and causing what they fear could be extinctions in some marine species if the lionfish invaders are not stopped. Here now is Reef's Lad Aitken.
The problem with lionfish is that when they're small, they're very beautiful and fun to keep, but they're also voracious carnivores, and they tend to eat the rest of the fish in the tank, at least anything that fits in their mouth. They also grow very quickly, and in many cases, they outgrow an aquarium. And add to that, they have venomous spines.
And they can grow up to 18 inches long, right?
Yes, we're seeing them here in this invaded range, much larger than they're known from the native range. The largest we've seen so far is over 47 centimeters, which is over 18 inches. They get quite large very quickly.
And people end up taking this fish from their aquarium and throwing them into nearby creeks or the ocean.
In fact, there are over 30 different species of non-native marine fish that have been documented in Florida waters. It just happens that lionfish is the first one to actually become established. That means it's reproducing, spreading in its distribution, and increasing in abundance. And that has never happened before in Atlantic waters. This is the very first time.
Now, what does the lionfish do to other marine life?
Well, it's a voracious predator, and it eats a lot. A recent study working with James Morris at the NOAA Lab documented over 50 different species of other reef fish found in lionfish stomachs. They also feed on crustaceans, shrimp, crabs, and mollusks. We found a whole octopus in lionfish stomachs. So they're eating a wide variety of prey. A lot of what they're feeding on are ornamental reef fish, but some of what we found are also commercially valuable species, like grouper and snapper, and ecologically important species, species of fish and shrimp that clean parasites off other fish, parrotfish that graze on algae, which competes with coral for space in the system.
So even the coral could end up suffering if the parrotfish are decimated by the lionfish.
Absolutely right. So we're not looking at a predator that's feeding on one or two specific things. We're looking at a gluttonous feeder that's eating almost everything that fits in its mouth, including ecologically, economically, and recreationally important species. The eggs and larvae of this fish are distributed on the currents, which tend to run north along the east coast of the U.S. via the Gulf Stream current, but also over into the Bahamas and further south through the Caribbean. And what we're seeing now are the eggs and larvae of fish that have become established south of us in the Caribbean coming back to repopulate our waters.
Oh, so they have made a circle in the Atlantic, and now Florida is getting this huge expansion in population of eggs and new fish coming from southern waters up to Florida.
That's correct.
How serious is it, and what can you do?
Well, we're very concerned about the impact this fish can cause. They feed a lot. They grow very quickly. They reach reproductive age very early in life, and they're capable of reproducing every 4 days with 30,000 eggs per spawning event.
My God.
And when you add all of those factors up, and the fact that they're a venomous fish and have few, if any, predators in this new range, it is not painting a very good picture.
If it's not stopped some way, what do you think would be the fate of the marine life in, say, Florida and the Keys just in the next 5 or 10 years if the lionfish continues to increase in population and run amok?
Well, there are a number of different scenarios. One scenario could be that native predators learn to feed on lionfish. Since we haven't seen that happen much in the Carolinas or the Bahamas over the last 5 years, I don't think that's a likely scenario. Another could be that the lionfish just feeds its way out of a food supply, and then the population of lionfish would crash. But then what is our system going to look like after that happens? Are we going to see extinction of some of our native species? Are we going to see the populations of some of our native species reduced to the point that they can't recover? We don't know the answers to those questions, and we probably won't until they happen. But indications are it's not going to be a good situation, and we need to figure out what we can do about it.
What do you think is the best next step in trying to control or even eradicate the lionfish?
Having everybody on the same page as far as a plan of action and removing the lionfish as soon as they're sighted to help prevent their establishment in that area.
You mean that you're taking the human population to go out and literally find and take these stinging lionfish out of the water and do what?
Well, you're right. We are taking the human population. We know that we are the top predator in the oceans, and we have plenty of examples of being able to wipe out fish stocks. Unfortunately, this is a case where we have a fish stock we want to wipe out. So we are working with divers and fishers and those likely to encounter lionfish and training them into how to collect and handle the fish and remove them when they are sighted.
Have you ever been stung?
Yes, I have, and it is not something I would encourage anyone to experience.
Can you describe what happens?
I've been poked a number of times, and it's enough of a pain for me to know I never want to get severely stung. People I've worked with have been stung pretty badly. Their reaction has been severe, and they said if they would have had a machete, they would have cut their arm off.
Oh, my gosh. You're talking about serious pain.
Yes, it can be quite serious.
Well, then how do you humans go about gathering from the water, literally hand harvesting these poisonous fish?
Well, we should make a distinction between poisonous and venomous. The meat of the fish actually is not poisonous at all. The venom is only contained in the spines. So we have collected probably in the neighborhood of 4,000 lionfish over the last few years in our research projects. We also use a puncture-proof glove made by a company in Michigan called Hex Armor. And they make these gloves for the hospital industry where there could be stray needles, and those help prevent spine punctures. So through proper training and being careful in handling the fish, we found that we can minimize the risk. We've been able to collect 20 or 30 lionfish into a single collection bag on a single dive by one dive team. Then the lionfish brought back up at the end of the dive. Depending on the scenario, they're either euthanized if we're going to be doing research on those fish, or they're placed on ice if they're going to be eaten. And that may surprise a lot of people, but lionfish are actually a very good eating fish. So we're working to develop the food market for this fish as well as another way to control the population.
This is one species of fish that you would love to have overfished for restaurants.
Absolutely. And it's a delicacy. It is a very good eating fish. As Bermuda says in their programs, eat them to beat them.
Eat them to beat them.
Yes. One of the other control strategies has been events to remove lionfish. We call them lionfish derbies. And last year, we held the first derby in the Bahamas in Green Turtle Key. And in a single day, 19 boats brought in 1,408 lionfish.
Wow.
As part of this event. And it was a great way to educate people and get the word out about it, but also remove a significant number of fish from that area. And we had a big cookout at the end and served up lionfish and had an award ceremony. And we're planning on conducting many more of those derbies, not just in the Bahamas, but throughout the Caribbean this year.
Ladd, what is the worst case if you can't stop the spread and increase of the lionfish?
Right now, we're kind of limited to divers and fishers removing lionfish as they're seen. But we also have a number of research projects going on to look into new technologies, designing lionfish-specific traps and other mechanisms that may help us be more effective in removing fish.
But meanwhile, the lionfish population continues to spread, as you said, that they are able to reproduce every 4 days?
Correct.
With how many eggs?
30,000 eggs per spawning event.
What do you think could possibly happen over the next 5 to 10 years if you all cannot get a handle on reducing this population fast enough?
Well, I think we need to increase our efforts exponentially, like the lionfish are increasing their population exponentially. And those efforts include more people becoming involved and more funding to address the issue. But I think we can keep up with it. I know places like Bonaire in the Dutch Antilles and the Cayman Islands, who've trained hundreds of their dive operators that are in the water every day to remove lionfish as soon as they're sighted. But I think examples like that can help us stem the tide and let us catch up to the problem with additional resources and research.
But you mentioned that you are worrying about the possibility of fish extinctions in southern Florida in the face of the voracious lionfish.
That's a possibility. Lionfish, if they are not controlled, if they go unchecked, and if the scenario does not change and continues to increase, could have that kind of impact.
Extinctions.
Possibly. Invasive species are a major culprit in extinctions of other organisms through their predation. But in general, predation is a major cause of extinction in other animals, particularly in island systems. So that's a possibility. We won't know if that's going to happen, but if we get to that point, it's going to be too late to do anything about it. Extinction doesn't come back. So we need to address this situation in a serious manner.
Right now.
Right now.
Hmm.
Yeah, and George, it is as if this lionfish invasion in southern Florida and Bermuda and the Bahamas is a metaphor for our planet is getting so out of balance that where we once upon a time had life that had its islands and its oceans and its mountains and its pockets, that we are in a world in which things are being traveled and transported from everywhere. And now a fish that doesn't belong here is beginning to take over and eat the really valuable ecosystem. And in a very strange way, it is very similar to so many other problems on the planet. And to get involved, for anybody listening, especially down in the Caribbean states and Florida and up in the Carolinas, if you want to get involved and participate with REEF and go to these lionfish derbies and learn how to use these armored gloves that needles can't go into and the lionfish needles can't go into, and then stick around for what everybody says is a delicious fish dinner, then go to www.reef.org, and they have all kinds of information about this problem and where you can go to sign up. And also, for all of our Coast listeners, that at earthfiles.com, my news website, on all of these reports tonight, I have full in-depth reports that have photographs, and at the end, all of them have websites that are helpful and teach you more. And that includes a lot of websites having to do beyond REEF with this issue of what can be done about the invading lionfish.
That's a great story. Linda, I've got a friend of mine who has a saltwater fish tank, and he has one of these things in there. And I never knew the name of it until I saw it on earthfiles.com, but I've seen the fish a lot. And his fish have been disappearing in his tank. It's eating them.
That's right. Exactly. You cannot put lionfish in any tank. They will eat everything. And I asked him, I said, well, lad, if in the Indo-Pacific region the lionfish is not out of control, is not running amok and killing everything there, what is it? And he said, we would like to know, but the amount of money that it would take to try to find out what controls this fish in the Pacific Indo region versus the fact that it must not exist in the Atlantic waters. It's a fascinating scientific dilemma, because if they could find it out, they might be able to affect the lionfish. But he said, the problem is it's like dominoes. We have a planet that's out of balance right now. The lionfish should not be in Bermuda, the Bahamas, or in southern Florida. And if they did find out what it is that keeps the lionfish in check over in the Indo-Pacific, it might hurt even further the ecosystem of Florida, Bahama, and the Bermuda. And so we are dealing on a planet where humans are being shown we can't keep pushing everything out of balance. It's going to come back and whop us in the face.
Up next, Linda investigates mummies in China. What is that all about? That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I just texted my buddy during the break, told him why his fish are disappearing in his tank now because of the lionfish. He did not know that. He didn't know that at all. So after I was looking at the lionfish on your website, I see this hideous-looking mummy underneath it. What was that all about, Linda?
You're talking now about the unusual heads on newborn Turkish lamb and Zimbabwe goat?
No, I saw that, but this thing in China.
Oh, you're talking now about what I call the mysterious Bronze Age Europe.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, the face on that baby lamb is also bizarre.
I know, it's a whole other story.
Oh.
But coming back to, this is really one of the most fascinating stories I have ever gotten deeply into, and realized that until now, I had only briefly heard about the so-called mysterious mummies of Western China, but I didn't really know a lot. And now, because I saw a little article in Discover Magazine that says there's going to be an exhibit, the first ever in the United States, of three of these mummies from Western China, beginning March 27th at the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana, I began to do some research. And the more I researched, the more I became amazed. And then I talked with a professor at the University of Pennsylvania who is going to have new DNA research out in just about 2 or 3 weeks. It should be mid-March in one of the genetic journals. And this is a quote from him. Recent DNA research has shown that the Y chromosome haplotypes are a Western European kind of haplotype, close quote. This is supposed to be definitive work, at least on the tissue that they have done. And why is this so important? Because you go back 100 years ago, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were European explorers who traveled to Central Asia, and they went there looking for antiquities and things that they could sell back in Europe. But they also began reporting that they found fair-skinned and fair-haired, blonde, red hair, red beards, light brown-haired people that were mummified and so well preserved by the very dry, salty Tarim Basin of Western China. Now, the Tarim Basin covers 150,000 square miles, and it's on the northern edge of one of the biggest and driest deserts on the planet. It's called the Taklamakan Desert. And this vast desert has a route up on the northern side of the desert and down on the southern edges. And those were the two branches in the ancient Silk Road trade routes, because no traveler wanted to go across that big desert.
Yeah, so, who would blame them?
Yeah, so they would look for any kind of river routes around the edges of the desert, and that's how these two branches of the Silk Road came into be. And where these paths were, these Silk Road routes, there is where, in one place, there's several, but the one we're going to talk about a lot is called Churchin. And this is where some of the very first photographs of these fair-haired, light-skinned mummies were taken at the beginning of the 20th century. And in the language spoken by the local Uyghur people in what is called the Xinjiang region, Taklamakan, the name of the desert, means, quote, "You come in and you never come out," close quote. And it is in this area where more than 400 of these people in this very preserved state, beautiful, and in fact, some scientists say much better than the mummies in Egypt, believe it or not. And if you and the Coast listeners will go to this mysterious Bronze Age Europoid mummies in Western China, and you click, and to show you how impressive this story is and how very little has been known, and this exhibit in California should be, I hope, well attended to see some of this. If you go down through into past probably two-thirds of the way, you come to where I'm talking about DNA results from Cemetery 5. And there is a image. I'm hoping you can look at that, George.
Yes.
It is of a, what they call her, the beauty of Xiahe. And she is gorgeous. at 1800 BC means she's almost 4,000 years old.
You're way too complimentary, Linda.
Well, she's gorgeous. And look at that long red hair and look at that close-up of those eyelashes on that little photo below. And the preservation, that this is to emphasize how well-preserved these, what they're calling Europoid or Caucasoid, and some people will call Celt, but the professor at the University of Pennsylvania that I talked to about all of this, who has been in this region many times, and he is very sensitive about the use of the term Celtic, and it has to do with the politics of the region. And right now, everyone is referring to them as Europoids or Caucasoids, and the new DNA work is definitely saying that the male Y chromosome is coming from Western Europe. So now what I'm going to do is go into a fascinating discussion with Professor Victor H. Mayer. He's PhD and professor of Chinese language and literature at the University of Pennsylvania. He's in the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations in Philadelphia. And it is largely through his work over the years that we have managed now, through his efforts, to bring to the United States for the very first time, never seen before, that what they call the Tarim Basin mummies from Western China, first time out of Asia, to be at the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana, California, beginning March 27th. And now listen to a man who discovered these on his own in China quite a while ago. This is Professor Mayer.
The first time I saw the mummies was back in 1988 when I was leading a tour with the Smithsonian Institution. I had been to the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region Museum many times before, but that time they had a new exhibition hall. It was behind some curtains. It was very dark. When I went through with my group, there was a whole room full of mummies that hadn't been there before. And I was stunned because I wasn't expecting them, and also because these mummies were all Europoid. They were all looking like Europeans. They were Caucasoid. And they also had very wonderful textiles they were wearing, and hats and all kinds of tools that made me think they were a lot more advanced than I expected for the years that they were saying. They said these were Bronze Age, 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, and I said, this can't be, because they have all of this wonderful technology, and they're so well preserved. So at first I thought it was maybe some kind of a hoax, like Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, or that they were doing this to drum up tourist business. But then I sort of forgot about my Smithsonian charges, and I said, you go back to the hotel, I'm just staying here. And I stayed in that room for 3 or 4 hours and looked at all the mummies there and filed it away in the back of my head, because I wasn't an archaeologist at that time.
You were looking at red hair and red beards, correct?
Well, a lot of people say they're red hair and red beards, but some of them have reddish hair, some have reddish beards, some have blonde hair, blonde beards, brownish hair, brownish beard. So, you know, there's a range of tinges to their hair, but generally tend to be light in color, not black like people from East Asia.
They are referred to as Celtic mummies because of later DNA tests?
Oh, no, I do not agree with calling them Celtic mummies.
Okay.
I don't agree that they can be called Celtic. Maybe they are. Maybe they have some remote relation to Celtic peoples, but that hasn't been established yet. There's a lot of work that has to be done before determining who they're related to, what languages they may have spoken. One of the reasons people say, oh, they might be Celts. Now, I'm not one of those people. But one of the reasons is that some of the mummies do have plaids, and that makes people get very excited because they're definitely tartans or plaids. Putting that together with the fact that some of the mummies do have reddish hair and reddish beards, but I think more of them have blondish or light brown, so they're by no means all reddish, then people jump to the conclusion that they were Celtic.
Have you seen what is called the best preserved of all of the corpses, known as Yingpan Man, 2,000-year-old Caucasian, discovered in 1995, who had a gold foil death mask?
This gentleman will be in the exhibition at the Bowers, so you'll get to see him yourself. I have seen him with my own eyes many, many times. What's so important about Yingpan Man, and he's not quite 2,000 years old. We think now he's probably about 1,500 years old. So he's one of the later Caucasoid mummies. People actually really haven't seen behind the mask. I know what's behind the mask, but normally when he's exhibited, you don't get to see it. You just see his mask with the gold foil on his forehead and amazingly resplendent clothing that he's wearing.
What have you seen behind the mask?
The man behind the mask, yeah. He did have light brown hair, and he's very tall.
6'6", right?
Yeah, 6'6", the tallest of the mummies.
And he had blonde, perhaps a blonde beard?
Light brown. His remains were not well preserved. When he's displayed in public, it's always with the mask on and with the clothing. So that's what you really are seeing, this very elaborate set of clothing.
That gold foil death mask, that's in the Greek tradition, isn't it?
All across Eurasia, especially in the northern part and across the steppes. So I wouldn't attribute this necessarily to Greek influence. But there are Greco-Roman motifs on his clothing. So there are definite Roman classical motifs on the clothing that he's wearing.
Behind that gold foil mask, is his face recognizable in terms of eyes and nose? And
no, I can say that categorically. Not now. It is not. So I myself, when I first saw him many, many times, I would conjecture, you know, what did he look like? What's behind there? But the state of preservation is not such that he's well recognizable.
They estimated that he was about 30 years old when he died.
Yeah, 30, 35.
Do you have any forensic evidence about how he did die?
No, not for him. His physical remains have not been studied by physical anthropologists. But we do for some other mummies. A paper that I was a co-author on has not even quite come out yet with the top geneticists in China and also leading archaeologists. And it will come out in a few days. But it's probably the most important article written about the genetics of Central Asia, of this region. So it's a real breakthrough and done by two labs in China. This latest study in which I was involved shows that the mummies from a site called Xiaohe, that's also referred to as a small river, cemetery number 5, and it's also referred to as Urdex Necropolis. At that site, which dates to 1,800 BC or slightly earlier.
Almost 4,000 years ago.
Almost 4,000 years ago, yes. And one of the mummies from that burial ground is called the Beauty of Xiaohe, and she too will be in the Bowers exhibition. She is really stunning, and studies have been done on the physical remains of mummies from that site. These are the best quality controlled studies, and they have shown that the Y chromosome haplotypes are exclusively European, so that the male haplotypes are European. And the quality of the research is such that they can indicate a Western European kind of haplotype. So this is very exciting. But at the same time, this article shows that there's an admixture with East Eurasian, and it seems to indicate a combination with the mitochondrial DNA, that's the mother's DNA, the female DNA, with people from South Siberia. So it seems like people were coming across the steppes, mainly men. You know, men tend to wander around more than women, and forming families with local women. This research will come out probably within the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Is it true that there have been more than 400 mummies discovered in that one area?
Well, in the whole of the Tarim Basin, there are many sites where there are human remains found. And these human remains date from the early Bronze Age and down to the medieval period.
So from 4,000 years ago at the oldest up to?
1,000 years ago. Before the time of Christ, say, down to about the 4th or 5th century of our era, there are Europoid mummies at many sites around the Tarim Basin. Most of the sites are in the southern rim and the eastern rim of the Tarim Basin. And when I say Tarim Basin, I'm talking about that place where the Taklamakan Desert sits, one of the biggest deserts in the world. And it's also very dry and a lot of salty land there. So the dryness and the saltiness is what has preserved the mummies so well. Plus the fact that in winter it's very, very cold. So the people who died in the winter, they end up being freeze-dried.
Is it true that in the Tarim Basin that there are dolmens and stones marking in circles around where the mummies have been found?
There are a variety of different burial types. In the northern area, up in the mountains, in the high pastures, there are quite large mounds made of stone and earth. And then in the southern part of the region, there are a variety of tombs, some with marked with small piles of stones. There's even one site called Gumugo that has hundreds of wooden posts and an array of like solar array around the tombs. So there's not just a single type, but some of them do have small mounds of stones marking them on the surface.
Which is, again, similar to Western Europe.
Yeah, but this kind of marking of graves is also very common in Central Asia.
Is there any reason why this particular area, the Tarim Basin, would have been used as a burial ground?
That's a good question. How did they end up there? Why did they go down there? This area was not just a burial ground. It was where they were living, too. Now, it's a very harsh environment, very harsh climate. People didn't live there before about 4,000 years ago. The earliest inhabitants, we can determine for certain, entered the Tarim Basin around 4,000 years ago.
Fascinating, Linda.
It really is, George. And you ask at the beginning about the small image that I have on the headlines page at earthfiles.com. Well, when you go to the report, and not too far down, there is a very large image that I have that shows this spiral that has rays coming out from the spiral on the man's right temple, and it swirls around over his cheek, his eye, his nose, a little bit up on the forehead, and then in other images that look down, you can see that the yellow continues across his left cheek to his left temple. And the exact explanation for why his face had the swirling yellow ochre paint on it, and in that same burial chamber, right below him, the photo in the report, there is a what they call the Chechen woman. She was also in this tomb with the Chechen man, and she is wearing this beautiful, vivid, it's a robe or a gown, and her hair was a very light blondish brown, and it was braided. And you see her, and then below, there is a baby. And the infant is estimated in some instances maybe 3 months to a year, but not older. And it is an amazing photograph to realize that this was a family. The man, the woman, there were two other women in not very good shape. These were others were preserved, and the baby is beautifully preserved, is wrapped in a sort of reddish brown blanket, and then that is wrapped in red and blue, twisted like a yarn or ropey yarn, and there is a cap that is the same color as the yarn that is binding the baby's body, and sticking out from it is blonde hair. This is a child with blonde hair, and over the eyes, over each eye, was a blue-colored stone. And these are some of the more fascinating details that, in addition to the fact that this family was buried in the same tomb, and who put them there, lying beside this baby, and you can see it, was a sheep's udder, as if the mother had died, perhaps in childbirth, and this child was being hand-fed.
Up next, Conversations with Linda. We'll give you the phone numbers in just a moment. Skype's open, too, on Coast to Coast AM.